keeps peering at me, and I'm not sure if it's because of my hot little L.A. body or if he actually recognizes me. I don't particularly care. Grabbing the satin sleep mask, I shove it on, lean my seat back, and settle in to pretend sleep. I don't want to contemplate 40-something lechers or my parents and their meaningless relationship histories. I just want to think about Graham. I don't want to screw this up. I know I'm about to manipulate him in deplorable ways, but I'm a practical girl. The end justifies the means. This is something my parents have never, in either of their pathetic lives, done. Plan for the future rather than living in the moment. Graham is not a momentary whim, though I admit he was at first, but that was a very long time ago. I've known for a while now that he's exactly the kind of stable guy I need. He's one of only two people in the world I can comfortably talk to about what happened with Reed. God, Reed. What a torturous mess that was. When we met, he was 14 and I was 15. Both of us were recurring extras on the set of a soon-to-be-canceled sitcom. I'd catch him staring at me sometimes and he'd blush, or vice versa. I thought he was the most beautiful boy I'd ever seen. We talked a few times, but in short, nervous sentences on meaningless subjects, not in any substantial way. Then, a month later, we both managed to land minor parts in the same movie. It was like fate, in a way, though to what purpose, I have no idea. The cast was on location in Idaho, living in trailers. With no one else our age around, Reed and I had our tutoring sessions together, and we grew close fast. Our parents were too uninvolved to be around much, and the notion that production babysits underage kids is ludicrous. Yes, we were somewhat separated from the older castmates because that sort of slip-up would spell legal disaster. But for Reed and me, the situation was akin to being thrown into the same playpen. We could mess around with each other all we wanted to, and we did. I'd moved to L.A. with Mom when she married Rick, and the sitcom had been my first acting job. When the movie Reed and I were filming was over and we were back in L.A., we kept seeing each other. Neither of us was old enough to drive, but we were privileged kids of clueless parents. We hired cars and hung out frequently at each other's houses, which weren't too far apart. We were too young and irresponsible to be sexually active, but eventually, going all the way felt like a natural progression. Reed looked at me like I was a goddess come to life in his bedroom. He was reverent and adoring. I loved the feel of my hair spread across his pillow and his weight pressing into me, and the expression on his face when he stared into my eyes and whispered, "I love you." God, we were stupid. We used protection most of the time, but occasionally we'd forget, especially if we'd been drinking. Reed resisted drinking with me most of the time, or he'd have one beer or one shot and quit, something to do with his mother. And then came the night of the screwdrivers. We must have downed half a bottle of vodka between us, and we were both violently sick most of the night. The next morning, his dad discovered us in his room, passed out and hungover. After delivering a harsh parental lecture, his dad called my mom. Loving mother that she is, she sent a car around to collect me. Has she even noticed that I never came home the previous night? Who knows? When I staggered through the door, the only thing she asked, derision in her tone, not concern, was if I needed a morning after pill. The last thing I wanted to appear was dumber than my mom. Of course not, I told her, trailing my hands along the hallway walls on the way to my room. We use protection. She narrowed her eyes at me, and if she'd had any sense, she'd have never believed me. Instead, she snapped, "You don't get to be all high and mighty just because you know how to use a rubber, Missy." "Why the hell not?" I returned, my head throbbing. "If you'd known how to use one, I wouldn't be here to bother you." She slapped me then. And it wasn't like seeing stars, it was like sparks erupting and everything blacking out at the edges. Rick rushed in and said, "That's enough, Sharla," and steered her out of my room as I stumbled onto the bed. He came back minutes later with ice chips and pain pills. My ears were still ringing when he sighed, "Just sleep it off, Brooke. You'll feel better later." In his kind eyes was the concern missing in my mother's. He was weighing something he never got a chance to say because Mom began calling his name in that petulant tone. Patting my arm, he sighed and left the room. She preferred me to be invisible to him. I was starting to look like a woman, and all of a sudden I was a rival, or at least something conceivably prettier than her. She didn't like it. I don't remember what Reed and I fought over the night we broke up. We're so similar that if we both happened to be in a pissy mood at the same time, we would inevitably end up in a vicious argument. At first, he seemed shocked at the things I'd say, trying to hurt him, to get a reaction. But his temper was as bad as mine. He just had a longer fuse. When he'd finally lose it, we would say cruel, spiteful things to each other and accuse each other of all manner of sins. I confess that making him that angry was a turn-on at times. If I could get him to lose it and then rein him in at just the right moment, the passion he unleashed was insane. He'd pin me to the bed and kiss me so hard it hurt, choking back his anger and redirecting it gratefully to something more satisfying than screaming obscenities at each other. Sometimes I missed the mark and pushed him too far. That night was one of those. And then, for the first time, he didn't call me an hour later, crying. That reaction from him always made me cry, too, and we'd blubber apologies and reaffirm our love and the need to see each other, even if it was 3 a.m. I waited, but he never called. 2 days later, I was in a panic. I didn't want to call first and appear weak, but I was breaking down. I missed him. I wanted his forgiveness. I also wanted him to need me more than anything, and if he was staying away, that wasn't the case. So I went out to a club with a couple of co-stars from the last film. Girls in their early 20s who felt sorry for my little 15-year-old breakup woes. I had no problem passing myself off as legal with the right makeup, clothes, attitude, and a top-notch fake ID. Being fawned over by older guys didn't help like I thought it would, though. I was close to grabbing a taxi to Reed's house and begging his forgiveness when I noticed a guy with a camera. Failing in his attempt to be subtle, he was hiding behind a post that didn't quite conceal his girth. I knew he'd be spotted and shown the door any second. As he zeroed in on my friends, I decided on a different, stronger course of action. I would make Reed crazy with jealousy, and then he'd come back to me. I found a hot guy, pulled him onto the dance floor, and performed every degrading, dirty dancing move I could think of on him. I incorporated things I'd seen my mom do on the stripper pole she had installed in the extra bedroom for exercise, and the photog recorded it all. Reed and I weren't big time, but we were cute together, and Hollywood liked us. I had no idea that being idolized also meant people were salivating over the moment we'd split up and how it would happen. I was just desperate to make Reed cave first. The article online the next day made me out to be the biggest whore imaginable. So sad, she's so young. While Reed was cast as the naive boy who had no idea what his slutty girlfriend had been doing behind his back. Out that night, and the next, Reed was photographed leaving clubs, parties, and hotspots with a swarm of different girls until there was no doubt in my mind that we were done, and he was over me. I cried for 2 weeks. I barely ate. I couldn't sleep. I wanted to call and tell him I hadn't been with anyone else, that it was all a ruse. But I was hurt and resentful, knowing that was no longer true for him. My mother, fresh into her separation from Rick, sat me down and told me that the only way to get over a guy like that is to get a new one. I heeded her advice, but couldn't settle down to any one guy. And I couldn't exorcise Reed from my head. That's when I met Graham, who resisted and spurned me. No one rejected me, not when I was offering straight-up no-strings-screwing around. We were on location not too far from L.A., just beginning to film a movie. I'd known Graham for a week, and I already detested him for his high-handed dismissal. And then I figured out that it had been a while since I'd had a period. I peed on a stick and was stunned to find out I was pregnant. Abortion? No problem, sign me up. Until the doctor said how far along I was. Almost 10 weeks. Which meant it was Reed's. Absolutely, Reeds. I told them I couldn't do it. Not when my mother pleaded with me not to ruin my career, not when my father was called in to order me to comply, because, yeah, that's always worked on me. I've made the appointment and we're going tomorrow, Mom said, as though I had no opinion in the matter. Be a good girl and listen to your mother, my father added. I hated them both. Graham heard me crying in my trailer that night and knocked on the door. I don't know why, but I took one look at those warm brown eyes and I told him everything. Holding me while I cried, he told me that he and his ex-girlfriend were having a baby in a few months. She was planning to hand it to him and walk away, but he was hoping for a reconciliation. Brooke, this might be the most important decision you ever make. It doesn't matter if you didn't plan this. There's a choice to make, and you should make it. Decide what's right for you, whatever that is, and then do it. No one had ever said that to me before. And here was this boy, who wasn't quite a year older than me, sounding so wise and sure. Of course, I know now that in that moment, Graham still had completely undeserved faith in Zoe, so he wasn't exactly the soul of discernment he appeared to be. Still, he had a point about taking over the decisions for your own life. That was the moment I started doing just that. If I'm capable of loving anyone, it has to be Graham. The ends justify the means, right? The ends justify the means. Me. I'm in town for a couple of days, meetings over that fall project, dinner. Graham. Bad week. I've got finals and papers due through Friday. When are you leaving? Me. Early Friday. Sad face. Graham. Damn, not the sad face. I could maybe get away for an hour or so tomorrow. Me. Yes, please. Smiley face. Text me your address and I'll pick you up at 8.
Reed. Brooke. We're having dinner tomorrow night. Photos should be up Thursday. Make sure she sees them. Me. Yep. Brooke. That answer doesn't leave me with warm fuzzies. Me. Are you capable of warm fuzzies? I'm thinking cold ice shards. Brooke. Do you ever STFU? Me. Quit freaking out. I'll handle it. Emma and I are on our second day of local television morning show interviews. These are like an annoying, unnecessary rehearsal for the ones that matter, the nationally syndicated talk shows, the late-night network and cable shows. Most of these local morning anchors will never make it out of their 30s in front of a camera, especially the women. Not because they can't do the job, but because there's always some fresh-faced, ambitious 20-something who wants that job, will take less to do it, and will look hotter doing it. No wonder some of them look at Emma and me like they'd give anything to just punch us in the face. I may be exaggerating a bit. This morning, though, the female anchor is interrogating Emma as though she's personally responsible for a host of swept-under-the-rug hate crimes, leaning so far forward that Emma moves closer to me. Winona narrows her overly lined, heavily mascaraed eyes. Emma, you can't tell me there isn't something going on between you two. Look at the photographic evidence! Without her eyes ever leaving Emma's face, she points to a huge monitor in between her chair and our small sofa. I stifle a laugh. The cell phone photo I suspect Brooke of taking during Walt's show? Really? Everyone saw and picked apart that photo months ago. Emma says, and I lean up, chuckling slightly. Winona. My voice is like honey, and her attention swings to me. Professional 30-something women aren't quite sure how to react when I take such a familiar, somewhat condescending tone. That's a really old, really fuzzy photo, I shrug. As we've said in previous interviews, the whole cast got along really well during filming. We were all very close. When Emma almost turns to look at me, I press my knee against hers and she freezes in place. Good girl. Reed, I believe you had an old flame in the cast as well? Winona clicks the device in her palm, and the photo on the wall is suddenly a 4 years younger me, leading Brooke by the hand as we leave some L.A. hotspot. Both of us are smiling, me right into the camera, and Brooke looking at me. I haven't seen this photo in a very long time. Yes. My smile is similar to that of the boy on the screen, if Winona doesn't look closely enough. That boy is not yet the uncaring bastard sitting in front of her. She scoots an inch closer. Were you and Miss Cameron in contact between your tween romance and the filming of School Pride? I can tell from her cold eyes she knows damned well we weren't tweens in that photo, but I ignore her pointless taunt. Sure, I lie. Ignoring me, she asserts, because there are rumors that the two of you had issues on the set of your recent film. I laugh complacently and match her icy gaze. There's a reason they're called rumors, right? She looks like she wants to bite me, and not in a good way. What about now? Do you consider yourselves to be friendly now? What a bitch. I decide to throw her a fastball, which turns out to have perfect timing. Yeah, we hung out this past weekend, in fact. Thank God I'm occasionally truthful, because just as I admit this, she click-clicks and up pops a photo from 3 days ago in which I'm entering Brooke's apartment. She's clearly visible in the doorway, admitting me. I wonder if Brooke knows about this. I wonder if she even set it up with that photog girl she has on payroll. How else would this shot get into the exclusive hands of a common local news station when Star or Us would have paid a shitload of cash for it? Winona's facade crumbles a little at the edges of losing the element of surprise, but she rallies and turns back to Emma. So, if you and Reed aren't involved, is this due to your involvement with a... She glances at a card. Marcus Hoffpower? The photo on the wall changes to Emma looking bored to death, arms crossed, standing next to that conceited prick at his prom. That must have been a pity date. Emma is speechless, so I laugh and gesture to the photo, grinning conspiratorially at her. Ah, I remember this, the community theater guy, right? Emma nods, her lips compressing when she glances at the photo. Yes, at his prom. I shake my head, smiling and staring daggers into Winona. If he wanted to score points, he could have, I don't know, introduced her to his friends. That's what we do when we invite non-celeb friends to our parties. A glance at Emma makes it clear that she's grateful for my interruption. I turn and give Winona a mesmerizing smile. So, about school pride. We're both really excited about the upcoming release and ready to talk about the film. We brought several clips. I assume we can show your viewing audience a couple of them now. Emma breathes out a deep sigh the moment we shut the car doors, and I start the engine, letting it idle and purr for a moment. Wow, her face. Her mouth turns up on one side. I kind of expected her head to start spinning around at one point. Winona was tough, but I've had more hostile question-answer sessions than that. No need to pass that info on to Emma, though. Courtesy never works with people like her, so I don't bother. If you want to shift topics, you have to force it. With a smile and an angelic look, of course. Of course. We pull into traffic, and I'm glad for the heavily tinted windows. The last thing either of us needs right now is more public scrutiny. You looked miserable at that prom. Anyone talk to you at all? Shrugging, she says, "The waiters were nice." I laugh, and she gives me a grim smile in return, her head angled. How did you know? I mean, practically everyone fell for the story that I'm so conceited that I wouldn't lower myself to speak to regular people. I make a disgusted sound. Please. You're one of the least conceited people I know. Your best friend is a non-celeb girl. That's evidence enough that you're not above mingling with commoners. She smirks, and I smirk back. Let me guess. You told him you're moving across the country to go to school, so you can't imagine a relationship between you going anywhere, something like that, and he got pissed. I wouldn't be surprised if he wanted you to give him a leg up in the industry, and he saw his chance at that falling away. She blinks in surprise, and her hands open on her lap. I can't blame him for being disappointed about that, if that was the case. I'm shaking my head before she stops talking. Why should he put forth no more effort than cozying up to the right girl? Yes, there's a lot of luck and who you know, but we both had to work like hell to become successful actors. We didn't just get it handed to us, even if you are planning to toss it all aside to become an ordinary little co-ed. She clears her throat, a light blush across her cheeks. In the silence, I begin ruminating over John's usual phenomenal luck holding steady with that underage girl. Once I was gone and he got her to wake up, she was more than happy to be given cab fare to get to a friend's house so her parents wouldn't find out she was at some strange guy's apartment overnight. I'm 99% sure we all passed out when we got to my place, John said. What about the other 1%? John sighs, passing on a rare piece of insight. Dude, I hope we never have daughters. My best friend doesn't know about the possible kid with Brooke. I love John, but unlike Brooke, I don't trust anyone with that information. Thanks to her, Emma and Graham both know about it. Do you mind if I ask you about your relationship with Brooke? Emma asks. I'm glad she can't see my eyes behind these shades. I mean, damn. Does she read minds? You don't have to tell me anything. It's not my business, but you guys weren't friendly a few months ago, and now you're, hanging out together. I shrug, exiting the freeway in a split-second decision that will keep her with me a little longer today. You know that old photo of us that Winona put up this morning? She nods. I guess I can't blame either of those kids for what they did back then. Growing up in the spotlight, as you know, isn't all that easy to handle. So, you're what, friends now? I can't blame her for being incredulous. The idea of Brooke and me ever being friends is ludicrous. She glances out her window and adds, And where are we, by the way? I chuckle. We're stopping for breakfast tacos at this very authentic place I know. And let's just say Brooke and I have reached an understanding. Her brow knits as she takes in the East L.A. scenery. Is this a safe spot for us to stop? This car is like the Batmobile. It's bulletproof. She peers at me. Is that true? I laugh at her gullibility, and she swats my arm. Pulling into a patchy, fissured parking lot and trying to avoid the potholes, I park and pull out my cell. Emma stares at the row of multi-ethnic businesses while I make a short call. With a limited Spanish vocab stemming from a lifetime of Hispanic caregivers and housekeepers, I request my usual order doubled. 5 minutes later, a tattooed guy in a wife beater and a loosely tied apron exits the restaurant storefront with a paper bag and two coffees. He makes a beeline in our direction. The Lotus would stand out in this lot even if it wasn't yellow. My window slides down noisily. Gracias, Raul, I say, passing the coffees to Emma and swapping a 20 for the bag. Raul pockets the money and tips his chin up once, murmuring, De nada, before sauntering back inside. Handing off the cream containers and sugar packets to Emma, I unwrap one of the small stuffed tortillas, suddenly starving. I've already finished one and am starting another while she's mixing her coffee. By the time I'm backing out, I've finished a second burrito and Emma is taking her first tentative bite. Good? She nods. Potato and... Cabrito. I hope she doesn't know what that is. Her brow furrows. Is that... goat? Damn. I said it was authentic. She doesn't look too disgusted. Not as bad as tuna, huh? I remind her of our first official on-screen kiss. Michonne had admonished me for eating tuna sandwiches beforehand, and I'd played cool about it in front of them and then sprinted to my PA and demanded a toothbrush and toothpaste before we did the scene. Emma laughs while finishing her bite, holding a hand over her mouth. I can't believe you remember that. My answer is an indirect smile and nothing more, because all I'm remembering right now is the sweetness of her kiss. Brooke can't get her half of this insane agreement completed quickly enough for me.
Chapter 19. Graham. My research paper boasts a formidable title concerning Flannery O'Connor and didacticism, and not another complete or coherent thought. I've completed the research in bits of draft, but my deductions and conclusions are a jumbled mess. Thank God this one isn't due until Friday. I still have 48 hours to finish it. I decided to take a break and see what Mom and Kara are doing when I catch myself staring at nothing and composing a new story for Emma. She seems fond of the steamy narratives I've been feeding her every night, after which I take freakishly chilly showers. I committed to dinner tonight with Brooke, and I shouldn't have, not with everything I have to do. I suffer from a vague sense of guilt where she's concerned. At times I sense that she wants more from me, but she never says so. Leading a girl on isn't something I've ever knowingly done, and that's exponentially true for someone I consider to be a friend. But she's only pushed me for more once during the course of our friendship, and she was very drunk at the time. Ignoring that whole episode seemed like the best way to deal with it. Brooke regards her hard shell as strength. In reality, it's nothing more than a shield, though I can't say I blame her for it. I'm one of the few people she allows behind that barrier, and I've always felt the need to prove to her that relationships, including friendships, can survive without manipulation or exploitation. Whether I've been successful at that attempt is debatable. Until last fall, I was sure Brooke's damage was mostly Reed's fault. I still believe the relationship had a lot to do with it, but having met him and watched them interact, I think they're just too similar. Like their impairments run parallel, and some subliminal recognition of that similarity was the reason they were originally drawn to each other. Mom always warned my sisters and me that having been raised by a psychologist, we'd all know just enough to be dangerous. I guess I should lay off the amateur analysis. In reality, I have no clue how to help Brooke beyond preserving our friendship, so that's what I do. I meet Mom and Kara on the staircase. My daughter is obviously ready for a nap. When I pick her up, she drops her head on my shoulder after one huge yawn. Mom continues up the stairs and I turn and follow. I've got that emergency client in about 15 minutes, and then I have to start grading these damn finals. The stack of blue books in her arms is at least 4 inches thick. And don't forget I have that faculty retirement party tonight, and I'm dragging your father along with me. Crap. I forgot about the party and the client appointment, which I'm not telling her since it looks like I was on my way down to retrieve Kara because of it. I'm supposed to go out to dinner tonight. I totally forgot to ask about that, didn't I? She hands me Kara's bunny. Call Bryn. Maybe she's free. Watching me from the doorway as I lay Kara in her bed, Mom tries to pretend like she's not dying of curiosity. So not working.
Who did you say you're having dinner with?
I tuck Kara under her nap blanket with the stuffed toy.
I didn't.
It's Brooke. Mom's face falls.
Oh.
I can't help but laugh as soon as we're out of the room. Come on, Mom, you haven't even seen her in, what, 2 years? She harums. Has she made positive changes in her life since then? Started therapy? Gained some maturity? Or had a personality adjustment? Sighing, I tap out a text to Bryn to see if she can watch Kara. Mom, try to remember that you're a professional therapist. She takes my arm, a tactile connection she's always used when she wants to make sure I'm listening. I'm also a mother, and I can't help wanting what's best for my children. I frown down at her, knowing exactly what she's implying. Mom, I'm not dating her. One of her eyebrows crooks up in the expression we share. I'm seeing Emma now. I could have sworn Cassie would spill the details of that. When we get to my room, I start reorganizing the mess of books, journals, and paper on my desk and bed as she leans on my doorframe.
Oh, she did. I was just waiting to see if you'd tell me about her.
I crook an eyebrow back at her and she sighs.
Cassie liked Emma quite a bit.
A smug smile creeps across my face and then she adds, but watch out for Brooke. I think she has an agenda, whether you see it or not. I'm trying really hard not to roll my eyes like a 10-year-old girl. She makes it sound like I'm incapable of seeing Brooke in a realistic light. Mom, I know you think I'm awesome, but not every girl I meet wants me. Plus, I've known Brooke for 4 years. Don't you think I'd have seen some evidence of scheming if it was there? I never told her about that drunken mistake of a kiss, of course, and I don't plan to.
Are you sure you haven't?
She inclines her head as though she knows I'm withholding. I'm sure, I say in the interest of placating her. She sighs, walking up to me.
It's your life, honey.
Frowning again, she pushes the hair off my face, something she's been doing to me for about 12 years now. She likes it styled short, but has always deferred to whatever style I prefer, usually a little shaggy, unless I am required to cut it for a film role. Cupping my chin, she stares up into my eyes.
Just don't make me say I told you so, because you know I can't resist saying it.
I shake my head and smile. Duly warned, Mom.
Brooke. Graham. Can't do dinner tonight. No babysitter. I'm sorry. A million things pound through my brain, starting with, God damn it! And then I recognize what an opportunity this is. I can't freak out at a kid-related setback, or I might as well give up now. I have Rowena all set to go. If Kara tags along, we'll look like a charming little family. The speculations could be even better than photos of us alone. And Graham's secret would be outed, which will happen as soon as he gets the slightest bit more well-known, but doesn't need to be tonight. Tonight is about how level-headed I can be about his daddy obligations. Rowena will just have to work a little harder for her photos. Me. Why don't I come over? We can order in, and I can help you with Kara so you can get back to studying sooner. Graham, that would be cool. You sure? Me. Absolutely. Hey, you. I smile up at him when he answers the door. His eyes are warm and his smile is genuine, as always. He pulls the door wide, saying, Hey, Brooke, long time no see. Such an adorable nerd. He probably napped earlier in his jeans and slightly rumpled navy V-neck t-shirt. That one little strand in front sticks up from his disheveled mop of hair. Smiling, I reach up and make it blend with the rest. I'm wearing heels, but he's still inches taller, even barefoot. He looks good enough to eat, and my stomach flutters when I note his eyes scanning me head to toe. These jeans fit me like a second skin, and the silk top is fluid enough to flash curves and cleavage without explicitly doing either. "I'm sorry we're staying in," he says. I move past him into the foyer, and he shuts the front door and leads the way across the slate flooring. "I'm sure you had hopes of showing off that outfit." He takes my bag and light scarf, our fingers brushing, sending a zap all the way to my toes. When he turns to hang them on a brass hook in the entryway, I draw in a deep, silent breath. "What, this? You know me, Graham. Heels and silk are comfort clothes." "I haven't been in this house in 2 years, but it hasn't changed. His family is fond of cozy decor, a warm color palette, and natural elements. Pretty much the direct opposite design of my place. This setting suits Graham, though. A fact I'll keep in mind while apartment hunting tomorrow. I want him to feel at home when he's there." Without warning, Kara pops up at my feet and stares up at me, all huge dark eyes. I know from posing the question years ago that his family insisted on a paternity test when she was born, but those eyes are unmistakably Graham's. Her strawberry blonde hair must be from her mother. It's in need of a trim. And a flat iron.
"Are you a Gossip Girl?" she asks.
I laugh. No, I wish. They're all very pretty. She nods, her eyes never leaving mine.
"So are you. And you dress like them. You could be one if you want."
This kid is as observant and direct as her father. "Oh, well, thank you. Maybe if I let the producers know that you said so, they'll let me be on the show." I tap my finger to my chin.
"Which boy should I date?"
Nose scrunched, she says,
"I don't like the boys. Boys are kind of yucky."
She glances at Graham, who's trying not to laugh.
"Except for Daddy."
He shrugs as I arch a brow and smirk at him. "I agree completely. Boys are yucky. Except for your daddy." We order Chinese, and I'm impressed when Kara rattles off what she wants and then eats her whole meal with chopsticks, as though she was born with them in her hand. Wow. I don't think I ever even had Chinese until I moved to L.A. As far as Mom had been concerned, during my first 15 years of life, ethnic meant either Tex-Mex or a jar of ragu. Dad made a failed effort to broaden my cultural borders during obligatory weekends and parts of summers that I detested giving up for him. I resisted anything he suggested just to spite him, and arrived in L.A. with a hopelessly unchic palate. Reed was the one who introduced me to the broad array of the ethnic foods I'd missed growing up. "That's what you get growing up in Manhattan, a multicultural appreciation and an innate knowledge of takeout." Graham steals a snow pea from Kara's bowl, and without missing a beat, her chopsticks snatch a broccoli floret from his. Chewing, they smile at each other, and I marvel that even this interaction makes me want him. By the time I leave, we've put Kara to bed, and Graham and I have had all the chit-chat I can stand. Unfortunately, now isn't the night for me to slide onto his lap and beg him to carry me to his bedroom. The signals he's sending are still wholly friendship-based, and I know what comes of pushing him for something he doesn't know he wants. Patience is one virtue I have in abundance, when I have a target on which to focus. My goal with Graham isn't just sex and mourning after guilt. On his side, I'd feel no such thing. I want it all. Without warning, I hear my mother's voice in my head, referring to a man she recently started seeing. "I'm not gonna be some quick lay in the hay. If I want the cha-ching lifestyle, I have to be patient. I want it all." I lay my head back against the taxi seat and close my eyes. I'm not her. I support myself. Entirely. I have my own money. I make my own money. Unlike my mother, who hops from one man's bank account to another's, I don't now and won't ever need a man for financial support. I'm not her. I'm not her. I will never be her.
Chapter 20. Emma.
I had no idea how often you eat.
After this morning's interview in San Bernardino, Reed and I set off for San Diego. We'll do our last early morning interview of the week there tomorrow, and somehow he talked me into letting him drive us instead of flying. He's already claimed to be starving to death twice, though he admits to having eaten breakfast. First stop, 2 hash browns, 3 eggs, and orange juice at McDonald's. Second stop, a grande caramel macchiato from Starbucks and a protein bar from the glove compartment. Now we're keeping our eyes peeled for an In-N-Out somewhere just off the I-15, right before we get into San Diego, and it's not even noon.
I need a few thousand calories a day or I'll start losing muscle right after I pass out.
I scowl at him. I haven't so much as looked at a fast food burger in 3 months, and I've already planned a room service salad for my lunch. I hate you. He laughs.
You're going to get something this stop, right? Burger? Chocolate shake?
My mouth drops open. Are you serious? We're going to be on Ellen next week. Don't you remember what the media did to me last fall when I ate bread one day? Crap, I can't believe I just reminded him of that. He gives me a wicked grin.
Ah, yeah, the infamous baby bump week.
He chuckles when I roll my eyes and cross my arms.
Emma, you can't take that stuff personally. It's just meaningless gossip.
How can I not take it personally when people all over the world are discussing which cast hottie knocked me up? He makes a psh sound, dismissing my argument.
A bunch of stupid speculation, all proved to be fictional in the end.
I sigh heavily. That's exactly what I mean. Why should I have to prove that sort of thing to anyone? It's nobody's business. He's staring straight out the windshield, and I'm wondering if he's going to respond when he points and says, "Ah, there it is." As he exits the highway, he opens the center console, pulls out a Lakers cap, and shoves it over his trademark dirty blonde hair. He grins, his blue eyes well hidden behind his mirrored Ray-Bans.
What do you think? Regular guy?
Of course. Because a Lakers cap and Ray-Bans are automatic regular guy camouflage. We'd been lucky on the other two stops. The person at the window each time was older and hadn't recognized him. Reed, we aren't in Beverly Hills or even Long Beach, and you're driving a yellow... whatever this is. Pulling into the parking lot, he shakes his head.
It's a Lotus, and we're cruising around SoCal, not Kansas.
I shrug, suppressing a laugh, wondering if he's actually this clueless about regular people or if he's just screwing with my head.
Whatever you say, Mr. Regular Guy.
Once he lowers the window, the aroma of fries is overwhelming, and my stomach gurgles in protest. I haven't eaten fries since the last time Emily forced half of hers on me in her typical manner.
Get your ass back, would ya? It's practically non-existent back there.
Reed orders a burger with 3 meat patties and no cheese, wrapped in lettuce instead of a bun, and a gigantic vanilla shake.
Are you sure you don't want something?
Clenching my jaw, I shake my head, willing myself not to breathe through my nose. When we pull up to the window, the girl working the register tells Reed the total as she turns towards him, and then she nearly stops breathing. He hands her a 50, and her hands shake as she pulls bills and coins from the cash drawer. She has to start her tally over 3 times. Finally, she hands him his change, but forgets to count it back. Wide-eyed, her hands still trembling, she just shoves the money into his hands all at once.
Thanks, he smiles. And she looks as though she might faint.
You're welcome, she squeaks, backing away from the window before disappearing around a corner. Reed stuffs wadded bills into the front pocket of his jeans and tosses the coins into a cup holder as we wait for the food. This is just a guess, mind you, but I think she may have seen through your elaborate regular guy disguise.
His mouth twists up on one side. Smartass.
Just saying. 3 girls and 1 guy, all 4 of them stuffing into the tiny window space, deliver his food, which consists of 1 small paper bag and 1 large styrofoam cup. Our original cashier hands him the shake as four pairs of eyes shift back and forth between us, and the guy hands him the bag. It doesn't take long for them to figure out my identity, too. I hear my name whispered amongst them. "Would you like extra napkins?" a second girl asks, handing out a stack 2 inches thick without waiting for an answer. "Here's your straw!" The third girl waves it out the window, blinking rapidly as Reed reaches to take it from her hand. "Will there be anything else?" the boy asks, beaming. "No, thanks. This is perfect." Reed turns his smile on them again, and four sighs come from the window. I roll my eyes behind my sunglasses, not that anyone notices. We park near an exit, windows down, so he can wolf down the unwieldy beef and lettuce burger. He tries to hand me the shake. "Have some." "No." Toggling it back and forth, he turns on the full wattage Reed Alexander smile. "I got the large so there would be enough to share." "No." He takes a sip, peering at me over the top of his sunglasses, his blue eyes full of amused mischief. So good." "No?" I shake my head. "At least hold it for me while I eat, then." With the cup holders full of change and empty Starbucks cups, I'm tricked into taking the shake by my own courteousness. Crap! His stupid bunless burger smells good, coupled with the heady aroma of fresh fries from the restaurant behind us, and my mouth is watering from full awareness that the cup I'm holding is filled with several hundred calories of evil. "Emma," he says, his tone coaxing, "a sip isn't going to hurt you." By the time a couple of shifty-looking guys pull into the parking lot in a beat-up sedan, eyeballing not so much the Lotus as who's in the Lotus, Reed has lured me into taking a couple of bites of his burger, which isn't bad, and sipping enough of the shake that I just told him he's the devil. He watches the two men for about 20 seconds before murmuring, "Time to go." I barely have time to rebuckle before he's revved the engine, reversed out of the end spot, and accelerated straight out of the lot with the sedan in pursuit. I look back and they're right behind us. A maniacal smile spreads across the passenger's face right before a large black camera obscures it. The last thing we want to do is lead the paparazzi directly to the hotel. I spin forward. "They're right behind us!" Reed glances in his side mirror, smirking. "Not for long." We hit the entrance ramp, and he's going 90 before we're fully on the freeway. Gliding around slower-moving cars, by which I mean all other cars, he loses the sedan in the thickening traffic. Reaching for the shake, he curls his hand, still warm from holding the burger, around mine, and leans close to sip from it rather than taking it from me. Damn, that's good. I clear my throat and try to slip my hand out from under his, but he transfers his hand back to the wheel, releasing me. Checking his mirrors, he grins.
"Rule number one of tailing a Lotus? Don't attempt it in a Hyundai."
Reed. We're almost to the hotel when I get a text from Brooke. It's a link and nothing more, and I'm pretty damn sure I'll find photos of Brooke and Graham getting cozy when I click on it. I'll check it out once I'm in my room. "So, dinner tonight?" I say to Emma, noting that she's checking her phone as well and frowning. She doesn't answer. "Emma?"
"Hmm?"
She glances up, worry in the downward slope of her brows and the unfocused gaze of her gray-green eyes. "Everything okay?" Blinking, she shudders her distressed expression.
"Oh, yeah, fine."
My lips twist.
"Convincing."
She blinks again and shakes her head. "It's nothing, really, just... it's nothing." Someone must have alerted her to the photos. I haven't talked to Brooke in a couple of days, so I have no idea how successful she and Rowena were last night. But if Emma's response is due to those photos, Brooke's personal paparazzi must have nailed it. The traffic is bottlenecking as we get into town, so I can't do any more than glance at Emma a couple of times to gauge her level of turmoil. Staring out the window, her reflection is no longer scowling. While I don't get any pleasure from upsetting her, she'll need to be upset enough to break things off with Graham for this to go down as planned. Speed dialing my manager, I tell him we're almost there. "According to the Garmin, we'll be there in 5 to 10.
"Good. A bodyguard is waiting in the lobby. I'll have him move outside just in case."
George is always cautious, which I appreciate.
Very little sneaks up on him. The exceptions to that are my occasional dumbass activities, like that underage girl I didn't have to mention to him. Thank God and John for that. I hate disappointing George. At the hotel valet stand are a couple of bored-looking guys in red vests. A dozen feet behind them, our bodyguard for our stay in San Diego exits the hotel, big and badass, arms crossed over his chest and wearing the characteristic intimidating scowl. He could be one of those Ultimate Fighter competitors. I don't see any paparazzi or fans. A relief after the hasty departure from the In-N-Out. The valets perk up when they spot the Lotus. Normally, I feel possessive of my wheels and hate turning it over to valets, but I'm so over this car that I don't care. I told Dad to arrange available funds for me to car shop as soon as the premiere is over. I definitely want a Porsche. John suggested a 911 GT3. As Emma and I exit the car, the bodyguard steps up ahead of the valets. They hang back, daunted by his tank-like size.
Mr. Alexander, Miss Pierce, I'm Alec. I'll be joined by another security team member within the next hour, in case either or both of you need to leave the hotel for any reason, separately or together. Otherwise, we'll occupy rooms near your suite and are at your disposal during your time in San Diego.
Emma's eyebrows rise.
Thank you, Alec. It's nice to meet you.
He shakes her hand, giving us each his card and telling us to call him before leaving the suite so he or his colleague can accompany us wherever we want to go. The valets exchange looks, clearly unsure if they're even allowed to approach us. Heads up, I call before tossing the Lotus keys to the one nearest me. Alec has all the luggage except Emma's laptop bag, which she's sliding onto her shoulder, and mine, which she hands me as she shuts the trunk lid.
What does he mean, your suite?
She asks after I pass a couple of 20s and instructions to the valets and follow her inside. I shrug. I guess we'll find out in a minute. Production set up the reservation. I don't plan to tell her I was contacted for the specific arrangements of said reservation, so I know exactly what your suite indicates. The chrome and glass entry doors slide open soundlessly as we walk up to them, and the concierge meets us just inside.
Good afternoon, Mr. Alexander. Miss Pierce, right this way, please.
The suite is a two-bedroom penthouse. A bellhop transfers the luggage upstairs while we're getting our keys, and I'm signing my name and halfway listening as the concierge rattles off the various rider-required items he's handled for us ahead of time. For me, grilled chicken and hard-boiled eggs from room service available at any time. A shower with a clear glass door, not a curtain. Minimum 1,200 thread count Egyptian cotton sheets. 10 goose down pillows. 2 700 fill down comforters. Fresh flowers daily. Dry cleaning picked up and returned twice daily. A full gaming system and games, type TBD. Wireless controllers and batteries. Minimum 52-inch flat screen television. 4 new toothbrushes per day, different colors. A lint roller and a box of Crown condoms. Emma's list. Cold bottled water and a bowl of fruit. Shit. In comparison, I come off sounding like J-Lo. Fortunately, she doesn't seem to be listening, staring at the key in her hand and looking apprehensive. Once we're in the penthouse elevator, which requires one of our room keys to enter, I lean against the pebble-flecked wall, arms crossed loosely. Are you okay with us sharing a suite? I guess production fell for their own buzz. Just so you know, I've stayed here before, and the bedrooms inside the suite are completely separate. The elevator deposits us directly into the living room, the wall of windows opposite displaying an obstructed ocean view.
Wow,
she says. I don't think she's going to object to the suite. Come look. I walk to the window. When she follows and looks, I point left. Mexico.
Wow, she repeats.
What time do you want to have dinner? We can go out or have a chef come up and cook for us. I have to laugh at the look on her face, eyes wide and mouth slightly ajar. Are you sure you want to give all of this up to go to college, Emma? I'll bet your agent is already getting daily requests for roles someone wants you to consider. She turns and walks into the Asian decor seating pit, plopping onto a sofa.
He is, and I admit it's tempting.
She gazes around the room, her fingers brushing the soft leather under her hand.
This is tempting, but there are things I don't want to give up, even for all of this,
I said opposite her.
I've never been able to choose my own direction, my own future. What I wanted was assumed based on other people's opinions. My dad meant well, but meaning well isn't really good enough, you know?
I can't follow her reasoning about wanting to study theater instead of becoming a huge film star, but it's easy enough to understand the motivation to direct her own destiny. There's only one problem with making all of your own decisions, I say, and she waits for me to elaborate. If you make a mistake, whether career, relationship, or wardrobe-related, I smile and she does too. It's no one's fault but your own. You take all of the responsibility, all of the consequences. She nods.
True.
So, dinner. I vote for trying the chef, like, soon. She laughs.
How can you be hungry enough to think about food again? I'd look like a side of beef if I ate like you do.
I flex a bicep at her.
Are you saying I don't look like a side of beef?
The text from Brooke is almost exactly what I thought it would be. Photos of her with Graham. But instead of the two of them out together, she's standing on the stoop at his house, smiling up at him and running her fingers through his hair. And then they go inside. The accompanying article is all conjecture about what they were doing for the 3 hours and 15 minutes she was there. There's a perfect shot of her leaving the apartment with her Cheshire Cat smile. Me. So Operation Graham went as planned. Brooke. His kid was there. Me. What? Brooke. Shit. Me. He has a kid? Calling you.
Does Emma know? Of course she knows. What the hell, Brooke?
My head is spinning. I'm trying to keep my voice down since Emma is somewhere in the suite with nothing more than my flimsy bedroom door between us, but I'm pacing like crazy.
Reed, you cannot say anything about this to anyone, Brooke hisses. He knows he can't keep this a secret, right? Of course, but you have to promise me I'm not going to say anything. He knows about our secret indiscretion, after all. That's why you told him, isn't it?
Obviously. It even makes a weird sort of sense.
What about your photographer, Flunky? No way would she not reveal this.
She releases a sigh.
She doesn't know, and I'm not telling her. Yet. I want the first public photos of Kara to be the three of us, together.
I come to a solid stop. She has this more intricately planned out than I gave her credit for.
You are beyond frightening. You realize that, right?
What do you mean? She knows exactly what I mean.
Nothing.
Nothing except I'm glad she's not manipulating me, without my knowledge.
Emma and I are in San Diego. Next week we do a couple of San Fran stations in Ellen, and the week after that Conan and then the premiere. She's a little too comfortable at the moment. I'm going to throw her off balance a bit, make sure she knows I'm still interested.
Meaning?
Brooke, you know I don't kiss and tell.
Reed, don't you... Yeah, I don't really need to hear that tirade.
Chapter 21. Emma. Over grilled ciabatta and brie, Reed asks me about Marcus. I admit that we were dating and that he was correct in assuming I'd broken things off with him right before the disastrous prom night. Why do you even go with him, then? He tops off our wine glasses and sets the bottle back into the ice bucket. A chef arrived to make our dinner. She's in the small gourmet kitchen, so we're sitting close together on the sofa and talking quietly. I felt guilty. His mouth turns up on one side and he lowers his chin, a look that would have melted me not so long ago. Go on. I shrug, concentrating on spreading the brie evenly over the surface of the bread. It's always hard to break things off with someone. He takes the cheese spreader from my hand when I'm done. Why not wait until after his prom to do it then? You gave him too much of an opportunity to be an asshole, and he took it. My face warms. I was worried that he was expecting things to become more serious. I glance up to see that he's mulling over the back and forth that occurred between us. I thought it was better to be honest up front. He laughs softly. The honesty policy doesn't always work out so well, huh? I purse my lips. Well, actually, it did. I didn't feel guilty anymore after that. I knew from how he reacted that I'd made the right decision about him, even if it was a wretched night. My words apply to him last fall as well as they do to Marcus 2 weeks ago, and his eyes tell me he knows it. I am sorry, you know, he says. I swallow and ignore it when his gaze dances to my mouth and back. The server who arrived with the chef exits the kitchen and stops several feet away. Please excuse me. Dinner is served.
He indicates the small table adorned with linen, china, and a romantic cluster of candles. I worry again that Reed arranged all of this while pretending that production was responsible, and the repetition of his apology from March does nothing to contradict that concern. Just when I think he's dropped the subject, Reed leans back in his chair, twisting the wine glass in his hand and watching me, his eyes as dark as Graham's in the low light. So why do you break it off with Marcus so suddenly? He tilts his head. There's someone else, isn't there? Graham thinks I have an effective poker face, but that's not the case tonight with Reed. Either he's been spying on me, or my thoughts are as clear as glass to him. I could lie right now, but he'd know. He's already smiling as though he does. Who is it? He leans up, waiting. I'm saved by the server again as he removes our salad plates and delivers the main course of pappardelle pasta and roasted mushrooms, but the reprieve is short-lived and Reed isn't letting this go. Well? I sigh. It's Graham. His eyes widen slightly and fall away from mine momentarily. Really? And then those eyes flash to mine and away as though he knows something I don't. Interesting. Interesting why. He shakes his head minimally, his attention on his plate as he slices a bite. We dine in silence, and I wait for him to elaborate, but he says nothing more. Finally, he rests his silverware on his plate, folding his arms in front of it. He stares at me. I have one request.
Request?
What?
If he fucks it up, I want another shot.
Before I can sputter a reply, he holds up one hand and adds, I don't want an answer. I just want you to know where I stand, and I'm not going to interfere with whatever you two have going on. He smiles then, his expression far from angelic. Unless you ask me to. Graham told me 2 days ago that Brooke was visiting New York, meeting with people about the movie she plans to film late summer. They had dinner together last night, and he was late Skyping with me because of it. But he was completely open with the fact that she'd come over and had spent a couple of hours with him and Kara, and I was fine with it. Until I got a text from Emily earlier today, with a link to the paparazzi photos of the two of them. Suddenly, his devoted friendship with her isn't as easy to stomach. On one hand, they've known each other for years and have a mutually supportive history I can't hope to challenge. On the other hand, my best friend is spitting nails and telling me he's no better than Reed. Her last text asks the question I can't answer. He never told you he had a kid. What else is he hiding? It's true. I only know what he tells me, and my heart has no problem trusting every word he says. But I was stupid about Reed. I was stupid about Marcus. What if I'm being stupid about Graham, but I just don't know it yet? All I could hope was that the photos wouldn't look as bad on a full-sized screen as they did on my phone. Once Reed and I checked into the hotel and I shut myself into my room, I brought up the links on my laptop. On my 15-inch screen, they're definitely worse. Graham stands in the doorway to his home, a place I've never been, smiling down at Brooke as she runs her fingers through his hair, her breasts brushing against his chest. There's no awkwardness or irritation on his face. He seems fine with her touching him that way. I'm not fine with it. Knowing I had hours before our appointed Skype time, I spent the afternoon napping, reading, and watching Reed play video games, followed by dinner and ending with Reed's out-of-nowhere declaration. He'd asked me not to answer, and I hadn't. He seemed almost confident that Graham would screw up. At best, he's seen the photos. At worst, his new and improved relationship with Brooke makes him privy to information I don't have. His indirect allegation planted a seed of doubt that I can't reject entirely, as much as I want to. At 9 o'clock, I sign on and am so happy to see Graham's face that I almost want to ignore the whole confrontation. Hey, he smiles. At 9:01, I get a text from Emily. You are not allowed to ignore this, BTW. Ask him. Hi. All done with finals? He heaves a deep sigh. Yeah, one more paper to wrap up and I'll be finished. How are you? Snug in your hotel room, I see. Yes, I'm so ready to get up after sunrise again. I've been up before 5 every day this week. At 9:02, Emily proves how well she knows me with another text. I'm serious, Em. Ask him. I bite my lip, debating the words to use. Graham? Emily sent me a link to some photos. I hope he knows about them already, that he can explain them away.
What photos?
Of you and Brooke? I hate the inflection of my voice, like this is a harmless question.
Brooke? I don't understand.
He doesn't know. Damn. I'm sending you the link. My heart is pounding as I watch him pull up a browser and click on the link. No sound but the tapping of his laptop keys. It's obvious when the link is loaded. His brows knit and he looks pissed.
What the hell? This was last night.
He examines the 3 photos closely, and then his eyes scan side to side as he reads the accompanying story. I wait silently for his response. Finally, he pulls up the Skype screen, and my first instinct is to hide my face.
Emma, you know none of this is true, right?
This is what I want him to say, exactly what I want him to say. The last thing I want to be is a clingy girl who's so insecure that she can't handle her boyfriend talking to another girl, but I can't brush aside the uneasiness. But the pictures. The way she's touching you. A knock sounds on my door, and I'm glad for the escape. Just a minute. When I pull it open, Reed stands there with the room service menu in his hand.
Hey, did you want some... What's the matter, Emma?
I shake my head, feeling like an idiot and trying not to cry. I'm fine. He tosses the menu in a chair and his hands go to my shoulders.
What's wrong?
I'm fine, I repeat, stepping back and grabbing the menu. I hand it back to him. I'm not hungry, but thanks. He spots the open laptop on my bed and arches a brow. His voice lowers to a whisper.
Talking to Graham.
I nod. He takes my chin in his hand, looks into my eyes, and in the same low tone tells me,
Come talk to me when you're done, if you need to. Fantastic. He's definitely seen the photos.
I nod again, so he'll leave, and I shut the door behind him once he does. Graham's expression is shuttered when I return.
Was that Reed?
Yes.
Why is he coming to your room?
My answer slips out before I consider the implications of it. We're in a suite. He gazes at me silently, sitting back slowly from the webcam, becoming blurry. His hand lays curved across his mouth as though he's literally preventing himself from speaking. His fingers shift and 2 words escape.
A suite?
There are 2 bedrooms. My tone is defensive. He's questioning Reed sharing a living room with me for one night while the whole world is viewing photos of him with Brooke pressed to his chest as she gazes up at him, her fingertips grazing his forehead in an intimate caress.
Awesome.
What are you implying, Graham? He takes a deep breath.
I'm not implying anything. I just don't trust him.
He stares away from the screen, silent after this pronouncement, and my screen's image of him is still too distant for me to guesstimate his theories. His physical withdrawal is easy enough to read, though, even from thousands of miles away. The constricted sensation that keeps me from swallowing prevents me from replying as well. Not trusting Reed shouldn't affect Graham's confidence in me. Finally, he looks at the screen and leans closer, and I gulp at the lump in my throat, sliding down like a grapefruit in my windpipe.
I have a research paper to finish and turn in tonight, so we'll talk tomorrow, all right?
He says, and I nod and whisper goodnight.
Graham, what did I tell Emma before? That I'm not possessive? Screw that. During the past 3 weeks, we've spent an hour or more on Skype every night that we weren't together. She's relayed stories about her stepmother, childhood acting gigs, and Emily, and I've strummed my guitar and sung her lines of songs that I might or might not have written, which might or might not be about her. Tonight, we were off in 15 minutes. Her naivete about Reed Alexander was pissing me off, and I was about to unleash a whole string of assertions that can't be unsaid. I've watched my parents when they argue. Their disagreements seldom become elevated enough to include raised voices. But whenever my father's jaw is so clenched that he could grind diamonds between his teeth, he goes for a walk around the block. It doesn't matter what kind of weather it is, either. I've seen him take off in tempest conditions and come back soaked to the bone with an inside-out umbrella. The point is to never say words you can't take back.
I thought you were supposed to communicate with each other, Cassie asked Mom once, years ago, after Dad stomped rigidly out the front door. Isn't that what your whole, like, career is based on telling people to do?
Bryn and I eavesdropped from around the corner. We stared at each other in mute acknowledgement of Cassie's direct hit. Cassie was often Dad's advocate, though Mom usually told her to stay out of it. This time, she merely sighed.
Yes, but there are exceptions. When you find yourself about to say something that crosses a line, something that could cause irreparable harm, sometimes the best you can do is just not say that thing.
Dad would never say something like that, Cassie huffed.
Mom laughed once, no amusement in the sound.
Exactly.
I do have a paper due tomorrow, but the body of the paper is done. Only the citations page remains. Inadvertently, I've instituted my own version of walking around the block. Because there are a load of words threading through my skull right now, and none of them are easygoing or objective. I don't fault Reed for his multitude of casual hookups. I'm a guy. I've had plenty of my own. And I'm not that big of a hypocrite. What I fault him for are the two times I know of that he actively encouraged a girl to fall ass over elbows for him, as Brooke would say, when he had no intention of sticking around. I could excuse what he did to Brooke as immaturity if he hadn't done the same thing to Emma recently. As soon as he doesn't get what he wants, he's out screwing as many girls as he can run through. Emma seems to think that because he's playing nice at the moment, he's above suspicion. Like he took no for an answer where she was concerned. But I watched him that night everyone went out, the calculating gaze he leveled on her. If this was 200 years ago, I'd have contemplated taking him outside and beating the shit out of him for looking at her like that. And that pinky swear thing he did with her would have guaranteed it. My paper submitted, I'm unofficially finished with college. At one time, I considered pursuing graduate degrees and becoming a professor like my parents. But that was a year or so ago, before I began getting more steady work as an actor. Standing in front of a class droning on about analytical symbolism and rhetorical theory while striving for tenure and churning out research, strangely, some of that is appealing. But I enjoy acting more, and I don't need to reach Reed Alexander status to feel successful doing it. It's almost 11 p.m. in San Diego, but Emma has to be up early to get to the studio. As sure as I am of her, as sure as I want to be, I don't want to think about the fact that I left her hurt and angry tonight, with no one to talk to but Reed Alexander. Not my brightest move. Damn. I didn't ask her about her interview in San Bernardino. I didn't find out if the drive to San Diego in Reed's bright yellow matchbox car was as uneventful as he'd predicted. I didn't tell her the end of the story where I'm the TA in her literature class, and she's the student who forgot to turn in her paper on time. I hadn't batted an eye at the photo and story of Reed kissing her at the airport. She told me it was on the cheek. The photo angle made it impossible to tell, and over so quickly that she didn't even feel it. I know how the paparazzi play their games, and I do trust her. So she should trust me when I tell her there's nothing between me and Brooke but a strong, committed friendship. I pull up the photos again and read the short blurb. Is another undercover romance blooming inside the school pride cast? Brooke Cameron, of Life's a Beach fame, was spotted cozying up to co-star Graham Douglas late Wednesday in the doorway of his Manhattan brownstone. They spent a long evening catching up, we presume, as Miss Cameron left the home alone and none the worse for wear after a visit lasting a bit over 3 hours. Cameron and Douglas play Caroline Bingley and Bill Collins, respectively, in one of the most highly anticipated teen hits of the summer. Me. I'm sorry for bailing on you so early. Skype tomorrow at 9? Emma. Okay. Me. Miss you. Emma. Miss you too.
Chapter 22. Brooke. Reed. Bullseye. She was pretty much in tears. Me. Goal. Reed. You are completely deficient in empathy, aren't you? Me. When required, yes. So, did you comfort her?
Reed, offered. She stayed in her room.
Me, losing your touch?
Reed, my touch is as intact as ever, thanks.
Growing up in the suburbs of Austin meant playing soccer. I got stuck in the goal far too often during the first couple of seasons, and since my team sucked ass, I was repeatedly scored on. I often left the field crying and wiping snot onto my sleeve. My coach, another player's father, took my tears as typical feminine weakness, patting my shoulder and telling me not to cry. Oh, we'll show him what for next time. Coach Will missed the point. I wasn't dejected. I was pissed as hell that my team didn't have a single player who deserved to call herself a defender, including his incompetent, stuck-up daughter. What my coach failed to understand was that as much of a girl as I appeared to be, fat blonde curls tumbling from my ponytail, the ribbons in my hair and threaded through my shoes perfectly matching my uniform, I was in actuality a carnivorous monster who wanted to chew up the field with my custom-ordered pink cleats. I was 6. By age 7, my father had me enrolled in summer soccer camps run by actual adult soccer players, and my natural abilities began to shape into skilled aggression. When fall rolled around, Dad demanded that they put me on a better team with a coach who wasn't, quote, an inept dumb shit who couldn't tell his ass from a hole in the ground, unquote. The first game of the season was against my old team. I scored 3 goals and fouled my ex-coach's daughter with a perfect ankle-hooking trip that left her face-planted in the middle of the recently muddy field. I had to sit out the rest of the game, which we won because of my pre-halftime scores. I was the star forward from that point on, and the only time I played dirty was when it was called for. People would be surprised how frequently playing dirty is called for when you're the prettiest, fastest player on a competitive first-place team, especially when that team is named the Butterflies. Dad stopped coming to my games once he had a new wife, a new family, and new and improved soccer players to half-raise and discard. I don't know why I gave a shit whether or not he came, but I did. Maybe because the soccer field was the only place I ever felt like he got me. So it was like I didn't exist for him anymore. When I started high school, I quit cold turkey, which was fine with Mom. She never understood sporty girl power Brooke anyway. She submitted my picture to a modeling agency and I got a print ad, and then I got a commercial to be shot in L.A. Mom had always staunchly refused to be a soccer mom. Stage mom was more her speed. The rest, as they say, is history.
Reed. Deja vu, eh? I hand Emma the pull handle to her carry-on and she holds it, and her laptop bag, firmly between us. Her tense smile tells me she expects me to respect the not-so-subtle barrier she's erected. Unless I'm willing to breach a wall of luggage, there won't be a repeat of the kiss on her cheek that showed up all over the internet a week ago, giving the impression of more than it was. Much more.
I guess I'll see you in a couple of days, she says, holding out her hand.
I've kissed this girl. Made out with this girl. Still remember her breathless yes from that afternoon when I told her I wanted her in my bed before everything fell apart. Somehow, though, none of those memories feel connected to her. This girl standing in front of me, extending a hand for me to shake like we're respectable business colleagues, and I've never had my tongue in her mouth or my hands up her shirt. I've gotten way too good at my own ability to disengage. I take her hand, but instead of merely shaking it, I lean forward and pull it up to my lips, kissing her just behind the middle knuckle. I guess you'll be meeting me in San Fran after all, huh? She inclines her head and smirks, pulling her hand from mine and readjusting the laptop strap. I guess. But I get the feeling that meeting Monday and Tuesday mornings at 5 a.m. for more morning show interviews isn't what you had in mind.
Correct. Come on, Emma, we have to go somewhere cool Monday night.
I turn to walk back around to the driver's side because we're getting some attention from other departing passengers who've begun to figure out who we are. She's flying home to Sacramento while I'm driving back to L.A., alone. San Francisco is a culinary heaven, and I'll have you back to your room in time for your Skype appointment. I wink at her and she rolls her eyes.
Okay,
she says as though she's exasperated and I've worn her down. I feel as though she just moved a game piece that puts her that much closer to checkmate.
and I can't help thinking what a bastard I've turned into. All's fair in love and war. A fine sentiment, if this was either. John, please tell me you have something stimulating on tap for tonight. The I-5 is 2 hours of spotty cell service with occasional ocean views until it veers away from the Pacific and loses all aesthetic appeal, becoming frequently punctuated with snarls of traffic in heavily populated areas. I'm already bored out of my mind, and I still have at least another hour to go, probably two, because of traffic anywhere near L.A. this time of day.
That depends what you mean by stimulating, man. On a scale of one to porn, where do you want to be?
There's a car full of girls next to me, all of them trying to see through the nearly opaque window tint. Right before the light turns, I roll the windows down and glance over. Watch their mouths all turn into O as the signal switches to green, and I'm gone.
One to porn, I'd say a solid 8 or 9 would do.
John yawns into my ear. 8 isn't out of the question. This girl who was on my econ project team is having a dinner party tonight.
Dinner party? What the hell, man? We're not 35.
Yeah, that's what I thought, until she dragged me to one last week that her sorority sister was hosting. Basically, everyone sits around being all pseudo-intellectual and getting stoned. All I had to do to seem like the smartest guy there was shut the fuck up.
So, pretty much your natural state when stoned.
Yeah. Less than 2 weeks until the premiere, at which point one of two things will happen. Most likely, Brooke will succeed with Operation Graham, and Emma, in her emotionally defenseless state, will fall into my arms with one good pull. Less likely, Brooke will fail, Graham and Emma will run off into the sunset holding hands and making everyone within a 10-mile radius vomit, and I'll be free to go back to the openly hedonistic life that other 19-year-old guys would kill to have. It's win-win, if I can just get to it. When we arrive, John's girl answers the door, pressing herself into him.
"You're late. I thought you weren't coming," she chides.
She's one of those squeaky-voiced girls, which fits her tiny size. Standing behind him, I can't actually see her. I only know she's on the other side of him because I can hear her. He hitches a thumb over his shoulder.
"I had to pick Reed up. You said you needed another guy for the boy-girl balance, so I delivered."
Her eyes peek over his shoulder then and immediately widened.
"You brought Reed Alexander?" she squeaks. "That's who you meant when you said you were bringing Reed?"
John isn't usually one to keep our friendship secret, our relationship being a major part of his social resume. Then again, he sometimes savors other people's shock when he introduces me as a friend in person. I don't mind. I actually sort of like it.
"Didn't I tell you that already?"
His voice is all blasé, and it's an effort for me not to laugh. He glances back at me with the same laugh-evading expression I'm wearing.
"I'm almost sure I did."
No, I'd have remembered that. Oh my God.
I step up to stand next to John, handing over a bottle of wine I took from Dad's collection right before we left. Hopefully it's something old and expensive, but not old enough to taste like shit. John makes the introductions, epitomizing the perception of no big deal.
"Reed, Bianca, Bianca Reed."
She takes the bottle with a strangled,
"Nice to meet you."
John chuckles when she tosses a small glare at him, mixed with newfound appreciation, before turning and walking into the open room and announcing,
"Hey guys, this is John and, Reed."
5 people, 3 girls and 2 guys, sit mashed around a table that looks thrift store shabby, but upon closer inspection was just made to look that way. The chairs and dishes are mismatched, too, as though this in itself coordinates with the cinder block walls and exposed pipes. Pretend grunge annoys the shit out of me for some reason, but I'm not here to pass judgment on the decor. 4 people stare at me open-mouthed. The other guy looks at me, then John, then the others, and back around full circle, confusion etched on his face. He says something to the girl near him, who says something back.
"Oh,"
he says, and then his expression catches up with everyone else's. Slack-jawed awe at a celebrity, in the flesh, at their intimate little dinner party. I glance at John, who eats this shit up. Bianca and one of the other girls share the open loft apartment. Everyone attends USC, where John is, shockingly, still on track to complete the business degree his CFO father expects. We're lingering over the barely edible pasta the girls made, and John is opening our 4th or 5th bottle of wine, and the talk has strayed to classic hipster topics, philosophy and music, neither of which will ever have a definitive answer.
Animated conversation ensues, and John and I follow his earlier edict for dealing with this kind of bullshit. Shut up and stay that way. Bianca's roommate, Joe, has turned narrowed eyes on me several times. So far, I've been ignoring her. Finally, while the others all talk over each other, I lean up, catching her pointed stare and hold it.
"Do I know you?"
I ask, and she laughs without a trace of humor.
"Really? I thought you celebrity types were above lines, especially something so passé."
Her voice is a direct contrast to her roommate's, husky and almost masculine. "You think that was a pickup line?" I laugh once and shake my head. "Sorry, sweetheart, but no. I was just wondering what I'd done to earn the death stare. I figure either I screwed you at some point and I don't remember and you're pissed, or I didn't bother and you're pissed. So, which is it?" Her mouth drops open and her eyes blaze. Grabbing two of the empty wine bottles, she stomps into the kitchen. I think about following her, but decide against making the effort. At least now she has a reason to hate me. A couple of